2. The Manse. Chapter 5. A long time ago, it seems now. From the void, the world of Eliathada looks beautiful. No one calls it that anymore. Almost no one in the galaxy even remembers the name, save for that warp-storm-tossed remnant of a race who used to own it, and they never come here. The word means sublime soul garden in a tongue that was once spoken the length and breadth of known space. Vaux considers that as he sits back in the lander. Like all vehicles of his legion, it is a bastardized version of a standard imperial design. Heavy, pocked, battle-worn. Mucus slithers down the interior of the viewport. Centipedes writhe in the corners of the chamber, their backs palpitating with a blotch of lurid coloration. Vaux is one of the few left that knows the name of this planet, and what it means to those who christened it. All planets in the Eye of Terror have names given them by the Eldar. The words are figurative and allegorical, twisting with the many meanings that are only possible in that treacherous Xenos tongue. Eliathada does mean sublime soul garden, but it also means prideful wasteland, and also dry valley of dreams. Vaux admires the way a single word can have so many interpretations. When he was in his mortal youth, he hated Xenos with a passion driven by his training and his bioengineering, and would not have appreciated the subtlety. Now that so many centuries have passed, and he has become so much less ignorant, he finds that he no longer hates anything very much. That is one of the gifts of the god, he knows. He does not know, however, why Mortarion chose this place to make his own. Perhaps the Primarch desired something pure to corrupt. Or perhaps he liked the name, harking back as it does to the greater garden, the one true garden, and saw some kind of fateful resonance there. From orbit, it is green, as verdant now as old Terra must have been at the dawn of time. It is an emerald in the void, spinning slowly amid a sky of violet and vermilion. Every colour on the face of the world is ramped up, distilled and intensified. Some of its colours do not exist in the purely physical universe at all, and have names only the demons can pronounce. From a distance, Eliathada shines like a lantern in the dark. Nor does Vaux know why Mortarion never renamed it. The Primarch, it is true, has an exaggerated interest in names, bordering on obsession. Since the great shame of the flight from Terra, in which the entire legion was harried and humiliated and nearly broken apart, that obsession has only grown. It was said that even during the Crusade, before the Primarch obtained his demonhood and became something little less than a god himself, those relentless superstitions were already making their presence felt. That was in the days before the Destroyer Hive, of course, while the Death Guard still resisted becoming what they were always destined to be. Now that they are on the other side of that transition, like moths squirming out of the chrysalis, it is interesting to see how much has been retained. So the world was never renamed. Those who were driven there in ignominy barely refer to it at all, thinking their retreat would be temporary. Even when that dream faded, and the manse began to grow and stretch out permanent roots, they never reached for some barbarian label or other to give a sense of solidity to their endeavour. It was left to others to call it the Plague Planet, mostly in mockery or fear. The hateful Thousand Suns, those arrogant and deluded tricksters, were the probable origin, for they had carried over their ancestral distaste of all things earthy and honest. Vaux despises the Thousand Suns more than he despises any citizen of the Imperium. In fact, he reserves mostly affection for the remaining defenders of Terra, seeing them as ignorant and waiting for salvation. But he cannot forgive the sins of Magnus's progeny, for they should have known what they were doing. Even in their folly and destruction, they have persisted in being a legion of, as Garstag puts it, arrogant, shit-stained bastards. Still, in all likelihood, it was they that coined the name, which the planet's new residents eventually took up themselves in a kind of defiance. The Plague Planet, it has remained ever since, even in the annals of the Imperial Inquisition, who speculate on what such a world must be like from the scraps and snippets they glean here and there. Vaux smiles. They can have no idea. It is Vaux's belief that there are only a dozen, perhaps two dozen, planets in the galaxy truly worth a damn. Terra, incomparable Terra, bauble of every war that humanity has ever fought, is one of them. Mars is close behind. Barbarus most assuredly wasn't, and it's very much for the best that it's been consigned to ashes. Soon, the list gets harder to add to. Until you get to the plague planet. Now then, here is a rock a warrior could die for. The lander plunges down to cloud level, and Vaux sees the familiar patterns of glow and diffusion. The entire globe is swathed in that humid cover, constantly changing, morphing, discharging and replenishing. The lander penetrates the outer level, and for a few moments the descent becomes rocky. Vaux relaxes, knowing that the transition is brief. Mortarion has generated those clouds to keep his realm shrouded from the rest of the eye. The Primarch ensures that they remain unbroken, lit from below by the exercise of his forges and his devilish manufactoria. Those clouds are the most profound poison, concentrated toxicity, capable of dissolving entire starships, if the whim of the god directs it, and only the Legion's own transports traverse it unscathed. The lander breaks through, and the hidden surface of the world below slides into view. When the Death Guard first arrived here, it was a formless sphere, studded with eldritch ruins and haunted by the thin voices of Xenos ghosts. The ghosts are gone now, for that species of indulgent semi-death is not tolerated in this place of dark fecundity. In its place, mountains have been raised. They are not natural. Their sides, glistening with cultivated slimes, are too steep, too dark to have been formed by tectonics or erosion. They are pillars of extravagance, thrust up from alien soil by spine-bending labour and the injunctions of sorcery. Over 10,000 years, the pinnacles have pushed higher and steeper, crowding up against one another until the entire planet's crust resembles a giant porcupine skin, the valleys glowing with vivid green fire, the peaks as black as the souls of their creators. Every inch of ground below is riddled with the tunnels of an immeasurably vast army. Once baseline human, now a variety of subspecies, steadily ground down and remade into the image of beasts. They drudge in the form of toxin-thick chasms, hauling raw materials for new spires of filth, sustained only by remorseless faith and the raw flesh of their own dead. They suck in spore-rich air, making their mutations gradually more flamboyant, and tread the old roads with packs on their misshapen backs. As the galaxy ages, those tracks have been worn away ever deeper, driving further into the crust of the world, even as the cliffs above them pile higher. Atop each of those cliffs stand great fortresses, the least of them a rival for the greatest fastnesses of the Imperium. Green aurorae flicker across parapets of black iron, briefly exposing the steep-angled profile of giant artillery ranks. Demon engines prowl the ramparts, their exhausts gouting black slurry. Immense shroud creatures swim in the sulphurous heavens, trailing long cloaks riddled with mould. Rib-thin campaniles toll endlessly in discordant monotony, their dull iron-cast bells hammered by teams of bestials to mark the creation of fresh joys and miseries. Deep down, buried within the world's unquiet mantle, are the fabled networks of laboratories, apothecarians, fermentation chambers, brew cauldrons, and rot pits. They merge into one another, blending into a twilight world of steam and toil, so that not one living soul, perhaps not even the Death Lord himself, knows their full extent. Spiraling chimneys vomit smoke every hour, adding to the inky, gravid clouds that swim across the bio-industrial landscape. Rain falls in thick torrents, cascading down the steep fortress sides and washing filth back down to the base of the chasms. Bacteria burst and divide in those cataracts, breeding voraciously in the humid depths before flowering in new and esoteric forms once the dim green sunlight filters back through the murk. Vaux casts his jaded eyes across the vista and feels his old soul rejoice. The plague planet is the lodestone of his people, the crucible in which their blessed gifts are developed. They inherited a dusty, dry morgue and turned it into a vista of magnificence. This is a vindication of their esoteric creed, of the belief that through entropy comes apotheosis, of the wholehearted embrace of mortality in all its truest and most honest aspects. The lander is shaking down, buffeted by moisture-heavy winds. The far horizon is lit by sooty pyres, and Vaux sees a mighty demon ship rise up slowly from a cradle of rusting spines. Even within the controlled atmosphere of the lander, he can taste the many and wonderful pheromones that only exist here. He hears the boom and roll of drums, the braying of indentured herds, the background drone of a quadrillion flies, all directed towards one glorious end. Evangelism. This place is the Mother Church, the incubator for every bio-creed and flesh catechism, the pregnant source, the fertile seed. It is all for dissemination elsewhere. The Legion will only rest when all planets are plague planets, and the bells toll out across a galaxy made into this image of spectacular decay. They are the willing disciples, cast adrift in a cold and insipid universe. For a long time they have been working alone, driven onwards only by internal commitment and orders so old they could have been ossified before the age of the doomed Warmaster. There was no word from the Primarch himself, who was said to spend his days in his mouldering scriptorium. The Legion held together during that time, although it has frayed at the edges, some tempted to cleave their own path, others drawn by the siren call of the Despoiler. That was always a regret to Vaux, who has not heard the voice of his Primarch for many centuries. But there is change in the air now. The plagues taste a little different. The chime of the bells has a strange timbre. Even the bestials sense it, and they lift their elongated faces to the seamy heights. The lander reaches its destination, a raised scaffold draped with black vines, half hidden behind the miasma of forge smoke. Waiting around the receiving platform's perimeter are a variegated collection of the plague planet's denizens, bestials wearing corroded metal plates and long rags, priests of the god in threadbare robes, several carrying great bells dangling atop heavy staffs. One of them, by his stature, is clearly unbroken, but he does not wear his armour. His fleshy, mould-black body is barely contained by iron threadmail. His sallow head, riddled with blotches that indicate some blood contagion, pokes stalk-like from a moth-eaten fur mantle. His eyes bleed softly with pale green light, and when he opens his tooth-spare mouth, the same light spills from between grey gums. He leans on a knotted length of wood, itself made seemingly fragile by the gnawed tunnels of borers, but which has somehow endured for as long as the war has. Not everyone knows the name of that staff, either. Vaux, who studies all such things, knows that it is Wormwold, the last sliver of living matter taken from Barbarus, and invested with all that world's spite and futility. Everything else was destroyed, but this final splinter is still clutched tight in claw-like hands. It is a relic. The reasons for keeping it, beyond sentiment, are unclear. Vaux descends the ramp and bows before the staff-bearer.
"Sliver Gristle," he says reverently.
Sliver Gristle is a curiosity. He was once Kregar, a plague marine who fought in the Great Crusade. Like the rest of them, he endured the defeat under Terra's vertiginous battlements and fought all the way back to the Shameful Eye. Unlike most, he did not remain locked in that prison, but found some means to slip out before the bounds were fully set. He travelled to Barbarus, where he managed to retrieve Wormwold before the virus bombs fell. Then something changed in him. He travelled strange paths, some say beyond the halo stars and into the deepest dark, and when he returned, he told even stranger stories. His speech had become as warped as his body, and it was reported that pacts had been made in the demonic choirs to consume his essence as the result of an unspecified slight or prideful action. That was never proven, not even by the greatest priests of the god, but something had definitely taken place. For Sliver Gristle cast off his armour, took up the threadbare cloak of a pilgrim, and never left the plague planet again.
"I am an eater of the Neverborn,"
he told any who asked. That, too, is unproven, and yet Vaux believes it. He believes that Slivergristle has been possessed more than once, but that his ague-shot body treats tapped intelligences as one more infection among the hundreds of others, and is thus able to dissolve them. Vaux further speculates that the youngest and most foolish of the demonic choir see this as a challenge and jostle for access to this most eccentric of hosts, hoping to master him and claim his soul. One by one, they have all been digested, leading to little more than corpuscent-lit halitosis. Such are the stories told of Slivergristle. Whether they have any basis in truth is doubtful, though his favour rides high among the many competing vicars of the plague planet.
"Sage Master,"
says Slivergristle, and wisps of ghost-light snag at the corners of his mouth.
"Home to welcome. Travels good."
They were. Vaux's warband, the Lords of Silence, have been enjoying the favour of the god. The Imperium is becoming less able to prevent their sallies from the slowly breaking jail of the Eye, and so they have feasted on worlds.
"The reaping continues," he says, in a polite formula.
They walk together towards the platform's edge. In the distant darkness, Vaux can hear lowing from the ritual abattoirs. He smells the richness of the moat-riddled air. He sees the green-tinged aurorae ripple across the jagged skyscape of spoil spires.
"Aware you indeed the tidings of?"
"Yes,"
asks Silvergristle.
"I have heard things," says Vaux, "here and there."
"True, of it all, true, and in that."
Slivergristle belches, and a puff of short-lived flame whispers in the darkness.
"So skeptical. No, I would not so listen. Called back in a reason, yes, lives he."
"I know the Primarch lives, Brother Vicar," says Vaux. "No, lives he. Blood now boiling, just old like again it."
These rumours were known about. Word had passed across warbands like the diseases they revelled in, somehow leaping across the immense gulf of the void to be half-heard and copied and doubted. That was, after all, why Vaux had come back. There were 1,000 reasons for daring the treacherous shoals of the Eye's borders again, not least the close pursuit of more than one chapter of the Adeptus Astartes. But that was the choicest of all, that he might be roused again from introspection.
"I'd believe you more," Vaux says, "were I to see it with my own eyes."
Slivergristle grins.
"Why you are thinking back here in this now, of course. He knows all it of, and watches, now moves, after so long."
They approach an archway. The lintel is of brass, and has the figurehead of a bloated face made in scorched metal. It is hot on the plague planet, a world lit by the offdraft of furnace towers and the humid warmth of culture pools. Vaux pauses.
"I have not spoken with him for a long time."
Silvergristle nods.
"Shall you wait just more, not much? Why you here are, in truth?"
Again, there is more than one reason. For respite, for recovery, to take counsel from Philemon, whom he wishes to take with him into Solace's bounds. To escape the weary competitions within the warband, just for a time. And yes, to dare the passage of the manse. All these things are true.
"This is home, brother," Vaux says.
Slivergristle laughs and nods.
"For now,"
he grins.
for now, but come, change it will. Oh, yes.
First he goes to his own holdings. They are high on a ridge, like all the domains of the Unbroken, peering over the lips of precipices down into the fog-choked valleys below. That is an affectation they all adopt, taken from the distant past. Once they were not permitted to ascend into the heights. Now they dwell there exclusively, adopting the manner of those who once oppressed them. Even those who came afterwards, like Dragon, who have no memory of Barbarus, even they adopt the custom. He walks old paths, treading on lichen-sponged stone. His passage is mobbed by herds of bestials, some of whom try to touch him, others who clear the path for him. They light lanterns, and butter-yellow light spills from panels of thick, liquid glass. From time to time he spies members of his order lumbering through dark fields with scythes in hand. Some salute grimly, in the old crusade fashion. Others stare at him mutely, their soft lenses refracting in the evermirk, and he wonders if they have lost their minds at last. It happens, sooner or later, in this place. It is always night on the plague planet. No dawn sun pierces its shifting clouds, and the only constant illumination comes from below, from the phosphorescent mists and the bioluminescent fungi. Every figure is a shadow, silhouetted against that warm emerald light. Even the demons, the greatest of which loom like bloated mountains against fiery cauldrons of soul fire. He reaches his domain, which has been called Hope's Revenant ever since he raised it. He remembers delving into the black soils with his own hands, back when the land was bare and the skies were lit with Xenos whales. He remembers raising the walls above the crags, mining the soft stone and cutting it down. He remembers the scaffolds and the work gangs and the endless slaves brought from raids into real space to end their days in exhaustion and decrepitude. Now he looks at the high walls, as black as oil, the parapets lit with that ever-present soft glow. He smells the demons slithering within, the little lords and the plague-bearers who can ghost between the stones, like gas. He breathes in and smells his house plagues, the ones unique to this plot, rotting slowly in the oubliettes. For the first time in a long while, Vaux is satisfied. Occasionally he thinks of another life for himself, one confined to Hope's Revenant, where he remains closeted with the books of numerology and the gardens, free to contemplate the truth and explore its mysteries. He is never given into it, but believes that the entire Legion shares this morose tendency. The greatest of them, after all, has been indulging it for 10,000 years. He passes under the high portcullis, and those bestials blessed with elongated necks bow to him. He processes across the inner courtyard, where his steward, Loam, waits dutifully. Loam is a bestial with a long equine face and buck teeth. His brown hide is wrinkled almost into oblivion and glistens from perspiration.
"Welcome, Siege Master," Loam says.
The steward always uses the proper titles. Unlike most bestials, he can talk, although the sounds are crude and he will never be eloquent.
"How stands the citadel?"
asks Vaux, looking up at the inner walls. They are streaked with moisture, dripping slowly. Flayed corpses bump and swing from one high tower, picked at by carrion crows. From somewhere far down below, he can hear the bubble of boil vats and smell the cooking from the refectories.
"Rots," says Loam. "Topples. Come home more."
Vaux smiles and keeps walking.
"I wish I could," he says,
reaching the great doors to his private apartments. Once within, he climbs the interior stairs, treading paths that he built himself. Every worn stone is familiar. Every smell is comforting. Once he would have scorned such notions, having been made immune to all calls of family or community. Now he values these things. He tends to his herds and his slaves, seeing what can be made of them and taking pleasure in their successes. After a long climb, he reaches his sanctuary. He takes an iron key from the ring at his belt and unlocks the door. When he pushes it open, a rich swell of old smells tumbles out, ones he has not enjoyed for a long time. He enters a grand chamber perched high at the pinnacle of the tallest tower. Bookcases line the walls, each stuffed with tome upon tome. Most are leather-backed, some bound in human hide, some in stranger coverings. They are mostly ancient, and their age seeps from them like a stink. They are all slowly mouldering away, flaking into nothingness, drooping from the extreme humidity. Worms burrow into them, gnawing trails through thick parchment. Ivory-eyed rats scuttle from stand to stand, hoarding scraps in their pink claws. The floor is knee-deep in discarded vellum. Quills scratch across writing desks, propelled by invisible hands, inscribing endless lists. Some are chronicles of years, others are typologies of phages and contagions, others are the names of allies and enemies. Vaux glances at one, the vellum rustling as the quill wobbles across its surface. Tofar, Mandravaxen, Yarnama. None of those words mean anything to him. They may do in the future, or they may not. It does not pay to listen too closely to the outputs of bound instrumental demons. He pushes his way towards a pulpit at the far end of the chamber. A single book lies open on its inclined surface, untroubled by the attentions of vermin. Its hide is as white as bone, and its pages as thick as a finger. It is impossibly huge, that book. If looked at from certain angles, it seems to go on forever, sinking deep into the library's mouldy floor, although from most aspects it is no thicker than the rest of them. He reaches for a metal quill standing in a dusty sleeve and dips it into a well of viscous ink. He holds it over the blank parchment and collects himself. Then he begins to write. Slowly, carefully, he traces out tiny letters in immaculate standard Gothic, of a grammar and idiom commensurate with the early Crusade. The first thing he writes is a name.
Brother Sergeant Caius Meldonia, Squad Taxis, 4th Company, the Emperor's Blades.
He pauses, remembering the face.
Location, Atama, Outer Reach, Spinwood. System marker, 4-5-5-6-3.
A faint smile crinkles across his sore-clustered lips.
The action had been prosecuted well. We were on the outward march from Tlitan.
He fills in more details, always in the same manner, not lapsing into Barbaran or Morteg, the debased vernacular of the Plague Planet, or even current-era Gothic. This record was started at the very commencement of his career in the Death Guard, and has been continued in the same vein ever since. When he finishes the entry, he carefully adds the date approximation according to both the Terran system and the Chronolattice, a scheme of his own devising that maps events to a more fluid set of points underpinned by warp dynamics. It is more accurate, at least from a number of important points of view, although it has peculiarities of its own, whereas the Imperial system becomes more inaccurate the further one is from Terra, and the further in time one is from the nominal baseline event. Chronolattice works forward to the end of the universe, a constant. Vaux names T for Thanatos, and becomes more reliable the closer the apocalypse comes. He takes time to cross-reference the entry with previous ones. He adds the relevant numbers to several interlinked grids, drawing the numerals with exactitude. Once done, he tallies certain esoteric relationships and determines if significant patterns have emerged, then logs them in a third set of ledgers. He repeats the process with ammunition loader Sylve Clued, resident of Atamar Orbital Station 4. Less is known about that death, for the stature of the victim was minuscule, but he records all that he has been able to determine, for completeness is a virtue. He has many hours of work ahead. The raiding season has been long, and he has much blood on his hands from it. He labours methodically, giving each entry just as much care as the first ones. The first biographies were written 10,000 years ago. This chronicle, this record of deaths served at his hand, stretches back to the dawn of the Imperial Age. For all Vorx knows, it may be the most complete history of any kind still intact. Inquisitors would sacrifice entire systems to retrieve it, if they only knew of its existence. More than one petty demon has been spun into instantiation purely as a result of symmetries picked out on the pages. Others of the Neverborn have come to Hope's Revenant and tried to consume the book, believing its contents might elevate them within their crowded and jostling pantheon. But the library is carefully guarded with ether traps and honey pits, and Vorx has designed many subtler defences to confound them. The book has no title, or, to be more precise, the book's title is also its contents. The final entry will be his own. Such psychic accumulation of killing generates a final artifact. When Vorx dies, the last page will complete itself, capping the immense and winding account of a soul's extension beyond all mortal tolerance. On that day, the tome will close, turned as if by unseen hands. The symbols will arrange and sift, the numbers will slot into new positions, and its fusion of occult symbology will reach apotheosis. It will be the final legacy of uncountable lives, stored and cross-referenced, counted and totaled, a product of magnificent uselessness. This is Vorx's great act of spite towards impermanence. He is smiling as he writes it, and the passage of time slows, dilates, warms up. He never knows how long it has taken once he stops. When he looks up again, a day might have passed, or a month, or many years. Such is the nature of the labour, and of the world on which it is performed. On this occasion, when the quill is placed back in the sleeve, and the last of the ink dries on the page, he turns to see a figure in his library. Even after so long on this strange planet, with its comings and goings of gods and demons, its creaks and groans, and its bending of the normal laws, he is taken aback. The place ought to have been secure, and he briefly wonders if his life is in danger. Then he sees who it is, and relaxes. The visitor is far more massive than he, a true giant of twisted ceramite and overspilling flesh. He even knows his name, for there are not many of this breed.
"You didn't knock, Slorn," Vorx says.
The Death Shroud Terminator does not smile, at least not obviously. His face is entirely hidden behind a landslip of helm and cowl and bursting flesh. His armour is a near black-green, like pond slime, and his ragged scraps of cloak and chasuble are a dirty grey. He breathes like an animal breathes, and his enormous slumped chest heaves with every intake. The god has been generous to him, gifting him innumerable alterations, blights and contusions. His long man-reaper scythe is warped and curving, more like a coil of rope than a length of adamantium, but it is all the deadlier for that. Slorn has been there from the start, too. He has seen the cold valleys of Barbarus and huddled in that world's freezing nights. He knows, just as Vorx does, how much better things have got.
"He's ready,"
Slorn hisses, a dry whisper through old vocal cords. Vorx prepares himself.
"So soon? You have been here 8 weeks,
says Slorn. That takes Vorx aback.
"Really? This is becoming eccentric now, Vorx. Do not rely on his favor forever. You could have done more were it not for..."
Slorn does not need to finish that. Vorx can do it for him.
"Were it not for the obsessions, the numbers, the recording, the completion of pointless tasks."
"Well," says Vorx, "I am ready now."
"He'll be extravagantly pleased by that," says Slorn. "Come with me."
The manse is not widely spoken of outside the plague planet. Few, even within the eye, know much of it, save for vague rumours of something colossal and imposing. Virtually none beyond the borders of the Hell Realm have any comprehension of it at all. For the citizens of the Corpse Empire, Mortarion has ceased to exist as anything but a warning from the past. That is as the Death Lord wishes it, and to understand this, one must understand the character of the Primarch. Even among his fallen brethren, he is a complex case. There is nothing straightforward about his rage, as one might say about that hellfire beast Angron. There is none of the control that the Witch King Lorgar learned to exercise. He has carried more with him from the past than most of his brothers, and it is said of him that everything came late and with difficulty. He was the last to succumb to the full embrace of the Pantheon. He was the last to arrive at the siege. He was the last to retreat from terror, it is rumoured, though others contest that. In Mortarion, more than in any other, is conflict. Hatred was everywhere inside him, of his father, of circumstance, of the Imperium, of himself. The poison of his foster world was hard to excise, and even if things had been handled differently by those in command, his would have been a damaged psyche. Vorks knows these things. They are not hidden from the Legion, and it does not lessen his love for his master. In his religion, damage is not something to be worried about. It is to be celebrated, cultivated, and, if possible, extended. They know, they understand, as the corpse spawn cannot, that the attempt to stave off corruption is the greatest source of disappointment. You can't keep it out. Learn to embrace it, to use it, or consign yourself to long and wearying defeat. For all that, Vorks is anxious. It has been a long time. Time flows strangely in the eye, but it must surely have been centuries, even as measured by the plague planet's dark rotations. The Legion has got used to silence, to making its own way. Typhus, that insufferable puppet, has been the figurehead for many of them during the empty years, though even his many successes have not erased the suspicion he stimulates in the older generation.
"We really do know what you did to us," Vorks thinks as he travels. "We don't forget."
He makes his way there on foot, along with Slaun. It takes them a long time, for the terrain is purposefully difficult. They wind along the steep shoulders of the pinnacles. At times they're forced down lower, where the air is like milk and the bestials run slave gangs of mortal humans. They stride past the altars, piled high with putrescence, and push their way through the squirming clots of flies. They see the mill wheels turning forever, and the bones that litter the sodden ground beneath them. After a long time, the land begins to rise. The black soils glisten with moisture, and dark leaves unfurl around them. Intelligences hiss at them from under warm shadows, and stagnant pools boil uneasily. Great menhirs lurch up along the roadside, worn by an eternity of corrosive winds. And then, at last, the walls of the manse become visible, in a caricature of defensive excess. The fortress's sheer side soar up from the green glow depths, hundreds of metres without handhold. The place is like a mountain itself, an upthrust of tectonics spreading far beyond all practical concerns and into the realm of megalomaniacal insanity. Towers thrust and spiral around one another, all spiked and hung heavily with lanterns. Stone stairways coil around the tilting flanks of the halls within, sometimes leading somewhere, sometimes terminating in kill pits or smother pans. Cathedrals to the god, empty places, rear up like abandoned tombs, mouldering away amid a mix of incense and the sweet stink of the dead, the dying, and the coming back again.
"You never quite get used to how huge it is," Vorks says dryly. "Still growing, they say," says Slaun, sounding uninterested. "The god only knows how."
This is the court of the Death Lord, and it teems with supplicants, ambassadors, sorcerers, and seers. Bestials man the kilometers-long battlements in conjunction with squatting slums of demons. Trains of pilgrims file towards the jaw gates, so numerous that they fill the causeways across half a continent. Priests of the god preach at them endlessly, their screeds punctuated by the dull tolling of cracked bells. The pilgrims stare out from moth-worn cowls, their famished eyes waiting for one of their brothers to fall, so that they might chew on a little gristle that night. Above them all swim skyships and gun barges, each leaving lines of inky smog in the hot aurora night. Beyond those are the calls of the drifting shrouds, eerie as whale calls, shimmering in ghostly inscrutability. Slaun does not need to make his presence felt here. As he and Vaux make their way towards the gates, the crowds shrink back of their own accord, abasing themselves and making the sign of three on their chests. Even the scourge demons, with their whips of infected leather, stop to stare at the death shroud. Blind groxhaulers shudder to a halt, and their wagons of softening fruit slosh on greasy axles. Bestials stare at them with big, shining eyes, panting and letting strings of saliva hang from their tusked jaws.
"Were the crowds always this big?"
asks Vaux, looking over the throngs with interest.
"They were,"
says Slaun, lumbering up to the portcullis.
"I never really know why they come."
"The same reason we do."
Slaun signals to the watchers far above. The iron bars begin to grind open.
"Only we can get in."
The gates are, like everything here, a parody. They are, it is said, 7 centimeters taller than the Eternity Gate on Terra. Just 7. Mortarion did a lot of things like that. Petty things, mediocre digs at fate. The cupola is slightly taller than that raised over the Senatorum Imperialis. The walls are steeper by 7 degrees. Still, the effect is impressive. It takes 10 minutes for the parody gates to grind open, hauled by chained gangs of bestials. Only once they're pulled apart can the gloomy interior of the manse come into view. A pile of tottering, half-ruined stacks of rotting stones, jumbling and straining upwards, ever upwards, linked by crumbling spans and spirals, creating a fragile, bloated city that juts like a nest of thorns high into the clouds above. Mist curls around its foundations, boiling against the black surfaces and leaving filmy stains on the rocks. Greater demons bellow from spell jails lodged deep in the magic-drenched towers, making the sodden earth vibrate down to the world's core.
"Best not hang around," says Slaun, pressing on. "We are already late."
It is crowded in those courtyards and terraces. Obese priests shuffle from altar to altar, accompanied by gaggles of acolytes with their upcoming sacrifices wriggling in sacks. Sorcerers stalk among them, some unbroken, wreathed in snapping whips of force. Huge, misshapen creatures, limbs stretched and bellies bloated, stagger up the twisting stairwells, lowing and huffing. There are courts within courts. In some, astrologers consult swinging orreries and tilt their astrolabes up towards the narrow slits of thick glass windows. In others, alchemists toil over bubbling racks. In yet more, surgeons sharpen their blades against whetstones before turning to shivering figures strapped to their tables. Occultists with 7 eyes scribble on stone tablets, their quills dipped into the bloody slops of the still living. Demonologists bind screaming presences within daubed septagrams, while the air pops and wobbles from the obscenity of it. Butchers swagger up from the great refectories wearing blood-stiff aprons, and pharmacists struggle under the weight of phage vials. It is noisy, burgeoning, unruly. Every stretch of flesh is poxed and sallow, every stomach slack and boil-marked. Steam pours out of brass censers. Green-tinged flames belch from orifices carved within pulsating flesh walls. The chambers run deep into the earth below and high into the teetering spires above, all jammed with life and death and the many states in between. Vaux and Slaun do not pause to observe the wonders. They move further inside, and gradually, slowly, the crowds thin out. They enter regions lit only by thin tapers, where the stone is dank and covered in slick coatings of algae. The noise fades away, and soon the only other occupants are unbroken, like themselves, sullen and silent, pursuing their own objectives within the plague city's moribund reaches.
"Silver Gristle told me he had stirred," says Vaux.
Slorn snorts.
"Listen to him, do you?"
"Of course."
"I wouldn't."
Now they are in perilous places. They pass under sagging gates and out into an abyss bridged by a single rotting ropeway. There are shafts there, delved into the heart of the planet beneath, and from them come curls of unnatural steam. Vaux can hear machinery churning a long way off, and muffled shrieks. Everything echoes in uncanny ways, as if there are walls there that shouldn't be, or rooms that remain unseen. Eventually they arrive at the inner doors, modelled on one of the Sigilite's own portals, though larger, and with the old Terran designs bastardized into earthy reflections of the god's peculiar whims. Two Death Shroud wait there on either side, motionless, almost invisible in the cloying dark. They say nothing, but the doors sigh open at Slorn's approach.
"I'll wait here," says Slorn.
Vaux looks at him for a moment. He wonders if this is some elaborate trap, but that seems a trifle theatrical. There are many ways to kill someone on the plague planet, after all, and no one will ever come looking for you.
"Very well,"
he says, and goes inside. This is the inner court. Vaux has been here only 3 times before. Many within the Legion, even some of the most senior, never come so far. Only the word of the Primarch himself affords admittance, and those words have been scarce. The last slivers of activity are gone. It is cold in here, and hoarfrost hangs from distant ceilings. The floor is glassy with ice. The dark pillars glitter faintly. The clouds of flies are sluggish, and they crawl rather than buzz across the shadowy vaults. Vaux walks down a long nave. In design, it is Imperial Gothic, imposing, solid, grave. His footsteps resound eerily in the high space between columns. At the end of the nave, there is a throne, shrouded in shadow. Long banners hang from spears set into the arches above, each inscribed with the names of worlds. Scrolls lie on the stone floor, half frozen, their scripts a melange of human and Xenos tongues. The throne is high-backed, fluted, and crowned with a raggedy peak of skulls. Thick cobwebs smother it, and swollen spiders squat at the heart of them. It is far bigger than any designed for mortals. It was smaller when it was first made, but its granite and ebony frame has gradually cracked and extended, swelling out along with the bulk of its owner. Vaux comes to a halt. The darkness is almost complete here. All light and heat have been drained from this place, soaked away from an empty heart. It smells fusty, like confinement.
"Welcome back, Siege Master,"
says the occupier of the throne. Vaux has seen many things over his long service and is not easily daunted. It is impossible, however, to not be cowed by the sight of Mortarion. The Primarch was always an imposing figure. Lean, drawn, sinister, even when he retained mortal dimensions. Since becoming engulfed within the Pantheon, the last fetters of restraint have been cast off. He is gigantic now, a cadaver of truly monstrous proportions. His armor has been reforged and gilded with demonic alloys. His grey flesh has atrophied further, clinging to outsized bones. His back has erupted into spines and vents, while his shoulders are now clustered with muscles for the ragged wings that drape across the throne's ripped backcloth. When he breathes, yellow-green steam vents from an ancient battered rebreather. Vaux sees a concave chest rise and fall under a corroding breastplate. Seamy eyes peer out from under the deep shadow of a threadbare cowl. Pale gauntlets grip the arms of the throne. Vaux bows.
"It is good to see you again, Lord."
Mortarion stares at him. It is always hard to know what those eyes are witnessing. Vorx knows enough of the price of demonhood to know that the physical universe is something the Primarch now perceives only dimly. For all his immense power, he is clinging on, as all who make the bargain do. The majority of the possessed become howling imbeciles given long enough. But this is a Primarch, one of the sons of the Corpse Emperor, and there is something indomitable about them, even in their compromises.
I did not foresee this, the Primarch says.
His voice is like the grate of a tomb's gate being swung lazily open.
I did not foresee the galaxy cracking.
Vorx does not know what that means, and stays silent.
I had a different future mapped,
Mortarion says.
I believed my part in all this was over. My duties lay on another plane.
He chuckles, which makes his neck tremble and the macabre baubles across his armor rattle.
The Despoiler convinced me. He convinced all of us, one by one.
He coughs, and his whole body shakes, stirring the dust on the ground.
Did I know back then that it would be Abaddon? Horus's angry whelp. I often wonder if I should have. They were so alike, those two. For a long time I thought he was dead. And then I thought I'd killed him when he dared come here. But we were always wrong about him. Ha!
Vorx is not entirely sure he is being addressed. The Primarch was always prone to audible introspection, and the centuries cloistered here have only made him more solipsistic.
I'd resigned myself to what I'd become,
Mortarion says.
I kept half an eye here, half there, but mostly on the abyss. And that was the choice I'd made, to exchange the petty game for the great game, and leave the old worlds and the old wars to mortal hands.
His eyes briefly focus, and he appears to see Vorx for the first time.
But the galaxy has cracked. I do not know if the Despoiler intended that.
Vorx tries to make sense of this, and fails.
Apologies, my lord. I do not understand.
Mortarion looks confused for a moment, then recovers.
Yes. For you, it has not happened yet.
He leans forward in the throne, and the slight movement causes lines of dust to fall from the roof.
The Despoiler is ready to move. You will hear the call soon. There will be those in your service who already cleave to it and are waiting to throw in their banners with his. Not on my watch. No. Very good. But it's coming all the same.
Mortarion wheezes and draws in long breaths from the rebreather's filter.
Everything has been working towards this moment for him. I have to admit my admiration. He cannot let the past go. He worries at it like a wolf with a hunk of meat, wearing it down to the marrow. He will break the eye and loose his angels on my father's castle. And he will succeed, and that will shake the order of things. But it will not come without a price.
Vorx listens. Some of this has been hinted at by others, but he knows Mortarion sees things no others can.
I contemplated this and reflected on the count of years and what was done and what was not done, Mortarion says. And I surprised myself. I found the old itch coming back. I understood what would happen once the eye bleeds out into reality and glimpsed the chance to conclude affairs started a long time ago.
Vaux still struggles to understand.
You will take ship again, Lord?
He asks.
When the rift is complete, yes,
Mortarion says.
There are things I have seen, snatches of dreams that I never thought would be waked from. My brothers are stirring. You hear this? My brothers. Magnus revives his tedious old blood feud, but it will not end there. The few surviving loyal sons will be found again.
Mortarion chuckles.
Abaddon can do what he wishes. I no longer care for Terra. I was there and damaged it so deeply it will never recover. My business now is, you might say, within the family.
Vaux hears the words, no longer care for Terra, but does not take them in. That must have been some mistake, some lack of understanding on his part. But it is rare for Mortarion to speak loosely, despite all the vagaries and part prophecy that always litter his utterances.
I have seen this,
Mortarion says, cracking a half-smile that makes the puckered skin above his rebreather flex awkwardly.
I believe I am the first to do so. Gilliman will revive. The numbers tell me this, and I have traveled far within the garden to confirm it. There are groves that hiss his name in the wind. I look into pools and see his face staring at me. Gilliman, stiff, dreary Gilliman. I'd have preferred another one. The lion, perhaps, whom I always quite admired. But one will do, even the dull one.
Vaux tries to decide how much of this is real and how much is hallucination. The age of the Primarchs is over. All know that. They are either dead or spirited into demigods whose interests bend away from the physical and into the metaphysical. It was a failed experiment, and one whose effects have been slowly dying for 10 millennia. The age of the Psyker is on the cusp of realization, the one that will bring the next great test for the species. That is what has been believed here for a long time. But he says nothing. There is a keen light in Mortarion's eyes now, where for many centuries there has only been emptiness, and it would be dangerous to query that.
He lives?
Vaux asks uncertainly.
He never died. His soul was bound to his body. You could see its echo in the warp if you knew where to look. But the day is coming. And here's the irony. The gate will break, and that shall release him.
Mortarion is drooling a little now. A speck of saliva hangs on the end of the rebreather, teetering at the point of falling.
I'll be there to meet him, Siege Master. I wish to have you by my side.
Vaux is still working hard to make sense of it all, but the last statement is what he has been wishing to hear for millennia.
The Legion entire, Lord.
The Legion entire, Siege Master,
Mortarion says.
I'm calling them back, cohort by cohort. We're still a force for all the erosions. We'll answer the Despoiler's call and do so united. We'll help him break the gate, and once out, as the galaxy burns with warp fire and the stars go dark, we'll cleave our own path, not to the throne world, but to my brother's little kingdom.
Before he knows what he is doing, Vaux finds himself kneeling.
I did not dare to hope,
he says. He sees then, in that moment, just how truly powerful his Primarch has become. He had not realized how empty the campaigns have been without the Death Lord at their head. Despite all the decay, the infighting, all the many changes, Vorks is still a space marine, and somewhere within his addled innards he still possesses the gene seed that binds him tight to his master's will. Mortarion rises from the throne, an arthritic movement that sends dead skin cells shedding like grave spoil. He reaches out, extending a long, bulky arm, and lifts his warrior to his feet. The gesture is surprisingly deft, almost gentle.
By my side, Mortarion says, as we were before.
He is still smiling.
Prepare your ship. Get your fighters ready for the muster. If you have any unfinished business with them, any flotsam to eject, do so now.
How soon? Vorks asks.
I don't know.
Mortarion's wings extend as his body unfurls, and a carrion stench wafts out from under the gauzy shadow.
But make no mistake, all will change. For us, for them, for everyone. We will be out. We will have freedom the likes of which the galaxy has not seen since he walked among us. How to use it? Now then, that is the test.